Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 76. Today we examine a seminal article by Charles Perrow titled A Framework for the Comparative Analysis of Organizations, published in the American Sociological Review in 1967. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the framework and its relationship to the dominant theories of organizational analysis at the time. To get the text and other associated readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hello, this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen in a beautiful spring day.
Hello, this is Greta coming from the beautiful town Windsor in the UK.
And this is Tom calling from a very rainy and ugly Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Sorry.
And this is Samantha speaking from Mexico City. Very sunny here.
Welcome, and a special welcome to Sam, who has joined the cast as one of our new permanent podcasters. Welcome, Sam. Glad to have you on the team.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, and welcome to everybody. Today we've got a nice short article to cover, but what a jam-packed article it is. Compared to two very, very lengthy books that we've done over the last 2 months. So this is Charles Perrow's A Framework for the Comparative Analysis of Organizations from 1967. Let me just open the floor to anyone who wants to give a quick summary of the article.
I could have a go, Tom, but please fill in where I leave some gaps. So first of all, good to hear how to pronounce this name, because I would pronounce it as Perrow, but it's Perrow. So let me see if I can hold on to that. So the article that we're discussing today is called A Framework for the Comparative Analysis of Organizations. So the title already suggests it's a framework, and it was published in the American Sociological Review, if I remember correctly, in 1967. And, embedded in what we have started to call the contingency tradition within organization and management studies, it particularly looks at, how can we come to a framework, like a classification of different types of organizations, and looking at the role of technology. And the role of technology is very central in this article, and it also got me excited about it. And I hope will also be a lot of our discussion will be about what technology actually is. In terms of, the perspective that Perrow is developing, he has like these four characteristics of his framework. The first one, he says, is that technology or the work done in organizations is a defining characteristic. And so it's a view of organizations as a system to getting work done, which I think is a very sociological view. He also sees technology as an independent variable, looking also at the implications for organizational structure, which is the dependent variable. So in a way, there's some technological determinism there, which we've also discussed in other readings of the contingency school. He looks at organizations as a whole, so that's good to know in this framework. And he proposes that technology is a good basis for comparing organizations and coming to a classification. As he set out these four characteristics, as the general context, he then zooms into different things. One is, this distinction between task structure and social structure of organizations, where he defines task structure as control and coordination. For instance, the discretion that people have in carrying out their tasks, and the way work tasks is being planned, and the role of feedback and coordination, and then the implications for management, looking at different types of management of tasks, for instance, planning, you know, technological control, and for instance, supervision of production. You have to bear in mind that, you know, the type of organizations overall that Perot was talking about were industrial. They were mostly production organizations. And so one of the things is like organizations have changed a lot, the ones that we study today. So keep that in the back of your mind as you hear us talking about this article. And then, you know, in the article, Perot is also going into social structure. And basically what he does in the paper is he has this difference between four types of technology. And I would propose that where he uses technology, sometimes he means work. And so he makes this distinction between craft work, between routine work, non-routine, and engineering. And he says, depending on, you know, what work is happening in your organization, you know, the structure of tasks is different, and also the social structure of the organization and its goals are different. And he has like this nice 2x2s specifying, like, you know, what it means for tasks. He also has this table about values, which I thought we could zoom into, and then going into social structure. And, you know, why he develops, like, and gives, like, all these overviews and the 2x2s, you know, this is what it means for task, this is what it means for identity and stuff. He kind of argues that there's a relation between them. And, you know, organizational structure and the goals of the organization must adjust to the technology, he says. And I think what he means there is it must adjust to the work or the conduct of work. And later on, he pleads, therefore, for more mid-range theories, which apply to certain types of organizations. And he, in the article, he makes a distinction between different types of hospitals that can be very different, even though we see them as the same type. And so what he tries to address is this problem of even though the typologies we have distinguish between different types of organizations, even within that type, there might be varieties because the nature of the work might be very different. It might be routine, it might be more improvised. And so he kind of says that, you know, scholarship, and bear with me, this is 1967, should come to a better system to classify the different types of organizations that we're studying, particularly looking at the work that is happening and how that relates to the structure and the goals. So I think that's kind of the main argument of the paper.
Thank you, Greta. It is a great overview. So let's try to make sense of the context, right? To whom is Perot writing this for? And I agree with you. In a way, he used the word technology, but he very much means work. And I think that he defines that as the actions of an individual that is performed to make change in an object, which can be a symbolic object, can be other people, or can be, as we see in a lot of the discussion, like an industrial organization that are dealing with raw materials, right? And the idea is that he's trying to shift the idea that organizations are this kind of decision-making machines that you would have from the behavior theory of the firm, or this more social relations type of institutions that you would have with someone from Barnard, you know, or the human relations school. And he's trying to say that the production, the construction that takes place in organizations is the reason why they exist, and therefore is the foundation for us to understand what is an organization, right? And then, as I said, he goes and tries to identify what would be almost this building blocks that determined or shape, or determined shape is not the ideal words, but in a way are the foundations to understanding organization. As you said, it is this work that is the structure, the what he calls the arrangement of relationships, and all the related things like tasks, the nature of the materials in place, and so on and so forth, right? And all of this has a very clear agenda because it's advocating for a more comparative understanding first and a more analytical conversation. So regarding the analytical conversation, it's important, I think, to think where organizational theory was at this moment in time. There had been all sorts of more naturalistic, case-based kind of research, and he cites a lot of them. There is the one from Selznick, the like Goldner, the work of Michel Crozier, and all of that, they try to understand both the phenomena of modern organizations, which usually means bureaucratic organization, and also comparing that sometimes to less routinized, less bureaucratic settings, right? And trying to understand how these things, these animals function, so to speak. What is the anatomy, physiology? And he's trying to say, well, let's try to think of this in a more classificatory, taxonomic, as you will, that goes beyond just describing the animal as they are, but finding a common language through which we can go around and have a more shared conversation. And this paper is an effort to do that. And in doing so, he's trying to, you know, put on the foundations for what we now understand our organizational theory, because a clear claim is exactly that instead of just thinking of organizations in terms of their sectors, for example, like a hospital or, I don't know, a school, there are some structural properties or fundamental properties through which we can analyze them. And he's trying to offer that. And also, in doing that, trying to push for this more comparative, as you said, mid-range understanding of exactly what we may expect in a particular situation, which is very reminiscent, even though it was even before a lot, it is reminiscent of a lot of contingence work, right, that we have discussed in the podcast here, in trying to understand what is the task, the environment, what kind of particular arrangements are in place, what are the ideal. His vocabulary is less around fit, but it is almost like an underlying assumption. But it's very much trying to understand what are the central characteristics that determine the way organizations function, right? So it's the same kind of goal, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a terrific rundown, Pedro. And I had a lot of questions as I read through this, because it seemed to me like the language that he used, because he's coming in it presumed to be an industrial background. A lot of the industrial metaphor, he's taking one type. I use the term type loosely here, but one type of organization, and tries to say, okay, same idea can be applied to a much wider range of organization, and probably the one section of the paper that most explains this is the idea of raw material. You know, yeah, raw symbols can be viewed as raw material. You can make that argument, but that was what he did. So he basically tried to identify how different, you know, each organization has stuff that it works on, that it converts from an input to an output. And that process is basically what defines the organization. It's very good. Once you can get kind of past the use of the terms of the time, it makes a lot of sense. And I think we saw other works, and you know, I'll tell you what, his references that he uses, a treasure trove of other Talking About Organizations episodes past. But you know, he kind of shows how a lot of what he did, the ideas are in common with what a lot of other authors were thinking. This was not very far out of the box. This was not. I mean, it was a very good way of, you know, kind of like meta analyzing a lot of work going on.
Yeah, I really liked his definition of or his way of seeing organizations as systems for getting work done. But I was wondering if we could take a look at the definition he gives for technologies, because I think, at least for me, that made me think throughout the paper about the complications that such a broad definition brings for both comparing organizations and also understanding complexity. So yeah, I was wondering if we could kind of reflect, I don't know what you guys thought about the definition he gives. So he defines technology as the actions that an individual performs upon an object with or without the aid of tools or mechanical devices in order to make some change in that object. And as you said, Tom, the object or raw material can be a living human being, a symbol, or an inanimate object. So I don't know what you guys thought about that.
Well, I made a note there, as you meant, that isn't this just the conduct of work, which I thought was the essence of what he means when he talks about technology as, you know, an approach to get work done. I don't know what Perrault's background was. Please enlighten me, but perhaps he has a more industrial background where you know that the technology means something different, but that's how I understood it. And as I read the text, I was like, you know, in my mind, like replacing technology for work. And then the paper made a whole lot of sense, but there were particular sections, like small ones, where actually he talks about technological tools. And then I was like, oh, that's the way we speak about technology nowadays. You know, when you think about, you know, the organization as a whole, and then looking at technology, we're like, oh gosh, like organization use so many technologies, so it can't be. But if you think about the way work gets done, there's definitely some truth in that different types of organizations have their approaches. Definitely partly depends on the work at hand, what you try to accomplish.
So I think that this complication with the term reveals some of the assumptions in the framework, which is Perot is not trying to get at the work as it's done, as later people have tried to do exactly, you know, the practicing of work, let's say. But it's more about, as I understand it, the work system. So the kind of production apparatus that exists to accomplish the objective of the organization. So that would be the Tayloristic setup versus a lean setup versus, you know, just in time versus Taylor kind of thing. So that is the technology. So it's not the tool through which the person accomplishes the task, but the overall setup. And then you can see exactly, as you were saying, the industrial assumption behind, which is exactly this install base kind of how is a production system literally installed and the assembly line, so to speak. So this is the technology that I understand. But of course, because terms change and technology has become such an important aspect in the study of organizations and has become so much more complex and digitalized and so on and so forth, you know, it's hard to look back. But I think in those times, that's what it meant, right? So he's trying to go beyond the idiosyncratic way through which one accomplishes one's work, but the broader arrangement of resources that are in place through which work can be accomplished. At least that's my interpretation.
Yeah, right. And I would also add, just sort of following on the rest of that particular paragraph where he sort of gives some examples about different types of raw materials. Very clear that he's thinking centrally about a class of raw material that is transferred from input to output. So in the assembly line example that you gave, Pedro, so it's the raw materials are metals and stuff that is converted into something at the end of the assembly line. And he lists examples of how people can be raw materials for those things that are, quoting him, people changing or people processing organizations. Two terms that raised a couple hairs in the back of my neck when I read it. I would never use those terms now. But the thing is, you know, it's a single type of raw material or a single class of raw material being transferred from input to output. Whereas I might, in present time, think more in terms of how people, stuff, and symbols all together would be, you know, affected through some sort of a change process, course of performing work. So that single dimension, I think, really, it makes it a lot easier for him to, say, connect the technology variable with the raw material variable, the four variables that are listed in the paper, because it reduces a lot of complexity in the story. It also, you know, simplifies things to an extent that we might not be thinking of nowadays.
Exactly. So that's kind of where my confusion comes from, because as I read that paragraph that you mentioned as well, I thought, well, organizations at the very least will be involved in two types of raw materials, right? There's always going to be people, or almost always, and you're always going to have some sort of like material or symbolic thing. My question, and going back to what you were suggesting, Pedro, of thinking about technology as kind of this production apparatus, is that when you consider more than one type of raw material, and when you try to guess what he was kind of thinking about with this word technology, if it was work or if it was the apparatus, then it becomes really hard to distinguish between technology and structure, which is the relationship he's trying to argue that exists, right? So technology determines structure. And he does recognize this confusion, but in my opinion, he doesn't really, he only kind of recognizes it, but doesn't really solve it. Like this confusion that might exist or how organizational structure might be in this very kind of broad definition of technology, a type of technology.
I mean, in a way, these are the kind of things, and I think Perot probably were in contact with all these kind of researchers because organizational theory was very small back then. But it's interesting, he points that on how new frameworks are going to come and so on and so forth, and how it's important. He's very open-ended, right, towards the end of the article. And it's exactly that, because in a way, that is what the Aston School has done. And we had the wonderful episode with Bob Hynings, who was part of the Aston School, which was exactly trying to look structurally to organizations to do exactly this work of comparison. And there they bracketed the work and the task, and they focus on the structure, right? Standardization, formalization, the division of work, and so on and so forth. And then from that, these structural lenses then try to look how it applies to different type of organizations in particular sectors that are producing different kind of, you know, materials or whoever you want to call it, have different kind of goals, so to speak, right? So the conversation went exactly that. But I think what's interesting here is that there is still a recognition how this, what he's calling structure or technology, is very entangled with work. That got a bit lost with contingency, right? Because in order to be more parsimonious, they had to bracket all those complications and look exactly just as the more formal structure. So I think it's interesting to see this, the challenge of trying to keep them together and what happened later to untangle them and allow the contingency scholars to, you know, proliferate and do all sorts of studies.
That's a great point, Pedro, and I feel like we should make a choices podcasters now if we want to use the word technology in the prose original meaning, or if we want to talk about work, which I think is what the meaning today of what he describes as technology. I would be much in favor of the second, as I already said, and you probably are not surprised about that.
Yeah,
I think that's a good idea. I think that is a good idea. And we just sort of like, you know, for our listeners, just understand that, you know, we're sort of reinterpreting the text. This is fair.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, I'd like to point out two things that Pro is pointing out. And then looking at, you know, these four types that he says, he distinguishes. The first aspect is, you know, the number of exceptional cases encountered in work. You know, is work standard or routine, or do you have, you know, lots of novelty in your work? And then he has the second element, the nature of the search process that is undertaken by people when exceptions occur. You know, whether that is like logical, systematic, and analytical, for instance, you know, troubleshooting in a production plant, or is it intuition, chance, and guesswork, which sometimes is part of innovation? Based upon these two elements, he has this 2x2, which I think when you reinterpret it as work, I found really interesting how he works out throughout the paper. So he distinguishes between craft work, and which is, you know, becoming popular again as an area of study, routine work, non-routine work, and engineering work. I thought it was useful, like, you know, the distinction between engineering work and routine, because I didn't know, like, I guess like production work is like routine work, but the engineering is fixing the plant. So perhaps that's less routine, but it's still analytical. I love to have your take on that. And then he draws out like this different implications for, you know, task coordination, for the way people interact in the plant, you know, who do you identify with and on what basis. I find that super fascinating, actually.
Yeah, I'll take a first stab at that because I have a very interesting implication to offer after I finish my piece here. But you're right. I think sometimes there's a challenge of trying to differentiate how he was dividing, say, engineering from routine, what he calls routine, because a lot of engineering is routine work. But the type of engineering that he's talking about is one where, when he says many, that falls into the many exceptions but analyzable problems. So that would be one of those things where you would routinely have to fix or sustain or do work on the equipment because it frequently breaks. That would be an example of where, you know, active fixing it would be fairly straightforward. It is known, so it's analyzable according to his matrix. But you got to do it all the time because of the nature of the material, which is heavy machinery that constantly breaks. Now, the true routine where there's few exceptions, which would be more of like a regular assembly line type of an operation, yeah, you wouldn't have, you know, you would expect that thing, if it's working smoothly, you would have a very small number of defective outcomes and that sort of a thing. The craft industries and the non-routine. Now, he highlighted aerospace as an example of non-routine, which made sense, certainly at the time, because there was a lot of exploratory work, a lot of innovation going on. It's definitely the kind of thing where there's a lot of novel problems nobody's seen before, and everything's a problem. There is no stability to the knowledge or its application or any of that stuff. So the top two, the top part of that matrix really makes sense. Now, what I find interesting is that he drew that diagonal line going from the non-routine quadrant down to the routine quadrant. And what I saw, and I think will be reemphasized probably as we go through the other matrices, is I had this sense of either the desire or the natural tendency of gravity to flow southwest. He said this a couple of times in the paper, that there's like certain, one of the quadrants is one that seems to be ultimately the desired state of whatever organization you're in. But it was like, you know, that the organizations would love to be able to gravitate towards the routine, that all things, that you would have few exceptions so that you're not wasting energy or whatever, you'd be efficient, and that problems would be analyzable, that you would naturally learn more and you would be able to handle problems with less energy, so that you don't spend it, you know, you don't have heavy machinery down in the maintenance depot forever. And I sensed that there is a similar idea connecting with the other matrices, which we can get into later. But that's, I'd like to offer that as sort of like a takeaway that I got as I read this paper.
So a quick reflection, because as when I was reading and now listening to you all, what is interesting is that some of these elements of such framework have become staples of organizational research, right? So this one of task uncertainty or variability and analyzability has become a typical metric through which people have done all kinds of research. It's like almost taken for granted, right? It's one way through which you can differentiate and think and map all sorts of stuff. The other one that he does later in the paper is in trying to understand not just the organization as a whole block, as a monolith, but particular areas it talks about and how some of them are going to be less or more routinized and whether it is going to correspond or not to the environment or to the specific work that is being carried out, which has been taken by people such as Mintzberg, right? And the whole idea of these different organizational forms and the particular types of elements of the organizational structure and how to think that, you know, how it looks like, the particular, for the lack of a better word, the anatomy of these particular of organizations. And the third one, which is exactly what you're hinting at now, Tom, which we can see throughout the paper, there is a concern for efficiency, right? There is a concern for this kind, as I said, he doesn't talk in terms of fit, but he talks in this very industrial way about the optimum efficiency of organizations, which reflects a typical concern of industrial organizations of this world that has seen the Industrial Revolution and so on and so forth, which, again, I see is an important aspect of the affirmation of organizational theory. Even though this was published in a sociological journal, it was already starting the conversation differently because it was not about alienation. It was not about the way organizations reflect social, you know, relations in society. It was more about what is the problem that organizations try to accomplish within this own space, which is being efficient, producing something, and so on, right? So it is the start of this concern, which, of course, the continuous people took over and became a discussion about fit and how is you can be more efficient depending on how you structure, depending on the environment you are, and so on and so forth, right? So that is another, I think, important element that we can see the genesis here.
So I wonder if, you know, perhaps there is like a line of thinking here that got snowed under and that connects to what Tom was saying about like this tendency in organizations and perhaps also this tendency in scholarship to try to orient towards the routine instead of the non-routine. I was just, you know, using the proposition, if I may say so, Tom, looking at figure three, because this is like a small thing in the paper where he talks about values and how values might be very different depending on, you know, the type of work that is being conducted in an organization. In the highly non-routine type of work, he distinguishes between, you know, technological control and supervisory managerial control. And in non-routine, discretion of both is high, power both is high, coordination, he says, feed, I don't know what it means, and interdependency is high. But it shows, like, you know, it's flexible and polycentralized. So, you know, who has that control and the coordination is, I guess, more distributed, perhaps, or more democratic, I don't know. But these are like associations I have. And then when we go to, you know, the bottom left or the southwest that Tom was referring to, we have formal and centralized, you know, task structures. Technological control is low. Supervisory control is low. Power technologically is high, but supervisory low. And then he has planned, I don't know what that means. And then interdependency is low. You know, it shows like from a highly complex type of organizational structure for the conduct of work where you acknowledge interdependencies and, you know, you acknowledge that, you know, authority and power relies in different people at different times. You go to a very simplistic understanding of an organization where, you know, everything is centralized, you know, low interdependencies, everything is fixed into boxes. I don't know what you think, but perhaps there is something in there that we can unpack a bit more.
Yeah, let me see if I can. The coordination within the group, what it seemed to be, was between planning or feedback, was sort of like the either or. So in the case of the formal and the centralized, the routine, the coordination is a lot of it's in that routine case is done by planning. So you sort of pre-plan. Like the assembly line, you pre-plan how it's mapped out, and that's basically what you go with. And yeah, the technical power would be high because that would be what drives who makes the decision about who does what. It's all about the technical solution, whereas the supervisor really shouldn't. You know, it says supervisory low, which means if the supervisor is doing the job, then the supervisor really doesn't have to get involved because you have the mechanic with the wrench to fix the assembly line. Yeah, I agree. It really struck me on this to see how he laid this out because I could see where he comes from in the way that he describes all four of these types of work and then how it translates into where the power rests, how people coordinate. I mean, it's almost reminding me also of socio-technical systems. The episode we did a long time ago on Tristan Bamforth, that was a very similar idea because that was another case where the gravity was flowing southwest, to continue this bad metaphor, because there they changed the technology of how you do coal mining. And why did they do it? Precisely to try to achieve what's in the lower part of that diagram, where it's routine. And there's less chance of error, and it's consistent. You know, it's all of those efficient, exactly what you're talking about, Pedro. In that particular case, they brought in the people, you know, Tristan Bamforth explored the impacts it had on people, and it was not good. Whereas this article doesn't really go there.
I was exactly thinking about that. And you know, I was looking at figure four, which I guess we can put the people in there a little bit in terms of, you know, basis of social structure, yeah, just a little bit, perhaps, you know, thinking about how people connect and identify around their work. You know, the non-routine part and mentions the role of mission and character of the organization, competences as a basis of identification, which they call calls goal identification. And then the bottom left, the southwest, is instrumental. It says job security, pay, protection from arbitrary power. It's almost like, you know, the human part and inhuman part.
So a few reflections. I think the first one on this interesting question, whether organizations stand towards, you know, routinization, formalization, rationalization, and I think that's a great topic to explore more in the second part. I would just say that there is important to be aware of the historical context, that this was a moment, the first occupational professional body of knowledge to be exploited in complex organizations were the one of industrial engineers, tailor par excellence, right? And Perot is operating this mentality, and it's very telling that you talk about the Tavistock and how they join the party, so to speak, recognizing the limits of such thinking and trying to re-instill and look at issues related to the social relations that exist between people and trying to, you know, give and empower the workers to create and self-discipline and establish their quotas every day. The whole issue that we discussed already. This is the mentality, right? In the traditional, more, you know, prototypical idea of industrial engineers, you want to reduce uncertainty, you want to reduce variety, you want to achieve the optimal, effective use of your means and predict stuff, right? So the concern is very much here and is driving the way the thinking is operating, right? So it's important, I think, to say that this context and how as other bodies of knowledge joined organizational theory, some ideas were explored. The other thing is that I recognize the potential poverty of the framework, right? But it's important to remind ourselves what Perot was trying to do. When you are trying to start a field and you are trying to write against the idea that organizations are idiosyncratic, that the way people do their work is unique, you want to try to get at certain features that allow you to, you know, claim that this is a distinctive object of analysis. The same way when sociology started, you know, Emile Durkheim had to say there is a social fact, there is a thing that is beyond the psychology of the individual, whatever, you know, and of course it is reified and functionalist and everyone else has tried to expand and enrich these ideas. But it's important to say that there was something that goes beyond what the common knowledge would grasp at, which would be, oh, it's just people, oh, it's just what they're doing, it's just the sector. You know, so necessarily, I think this early work grasped the features. And I think that Perot, as you were commenting, is kind of aware, and he writes that, that this is not all there is, right? That there is much more and it'll be explored. And he tries to do a little bit of the social structure thing, which is interesting that subsequent perspectives from sense making to new institutional theory has showed that what he has in his figure there in terms of identification and teams can be applied to all kinds of contexts, right? People exploded the framework and said, well, these processes are happening in all types of organization and can more or less be applicable to different situations and explore exactly that, how it's happening. So, yeah. So just again, to put ours back in the context.
I wanted to say something about this point that keeps coming up about organizations wanting to move towards more routine work. And I must say, I didn't exactly get this from reading the article. What I did get that Perot is trying to say is that you have to be able to understand the nature of the work that you are doing and make sure that the structure matches. So like, and not to confuse routine as, you know, as routinized in a kind of in a structuring the work to be routinized or routine work as it is in the nature of the work. Yeah, I don't know what you think about this distinction. And then, so another thing that I was thinking as I was hearing you mention this point of organizations and maybe engineers trying to reduce uncertainty and have work be more routine-like is that I didn't really see much room in this framework for considering agency and interactions and how people in organizations might want or might be able to transform the work because it does seem to be very determined by the nature of the raw material. You know, this thing that we haven't discussed a lot about the stability of the material. Also, I mean, it's interesting to be considering this two by two, but also to go back to an earlier point we made about it's, you know, organizations might be handling different types of work. So then I was trying to imagine when I was trying to draw and redraw this two by two to make sense of everything that he's trying to put together, also how these will become even more complex when you have different types of raw material. And I was surprised that he doesn't touch on that point, given that the point of the article is to present a framework for analyzing complex organizations.
Well, he is a bit modest, right, in his title. It's just a framework. It's a D framework. But I do appreciate, you know, the point you're making about, you know, what does it mean for the people? There are implications, you know, in terms of what is the purpose of, you know, putting this in the context of organizational design and the way you try to design your organization at the time, what it meant for the people. Perhaps the lack of attention to the need to interact, the need to identify, the need to wanting to have a say about how work is happening. Yeah.
I was going to say, again, I think we can, maybe because we have been raising the classic for so much, we cannot hope and see connections. I think that this idea, you know, implicit that the meaning of the work for people and what does it mean to perform the activity is underplayed, because even today, there is this idea that manual work, industrial work, right, which is a lot of it's talking about, is not talking about lawyers in professional service firms. He's not talking about surgeons, you know, operating in the operating theater. He's not talking about artists. There is this tacit idea that unfortunately still lingers on, that this nature of work doesn't need this self-realization, right? It's the way people interpret the famous framework from Maslow that was not a pyramid. Check our episode and the further literature on that. But there's exactly this idea that, you know, that certain forms of work, you need to satisfy the basic needs, this kind of, you know, higher purposes don't apply if you're just, you know, creating material things and working in a factory. Of course, it's totally misguided, but has colored the history of organizational thinking and management a lot, right? Because there's the whole discussion that knowledge workers need something that people that are doing routine work do not. So I see a little bit of that, right? There's this idea that all you need is to get people to, you know, perform the things at hand. So there's one thing. The other thing I wanted to say is that I agree with Samantha in terms of the tendency towards routine work or not. And I think I see between the lines that he's writing against some emerging assumptions already in the 60s that there are stuff like organic forms or participatory strategies, whatever it is, and, you know, that have a value in themselves, right? Which were emerging in that time, right? The centralization is good as an end in itself and so on and so forth. So he's trying, I think, to maybe highlight a bit more, because he's writing against that positive bias around those kind of structures, right? And it's interesting that in a way, I think this still lingers on as well. But we probably can talk more about that in the second part.
We didn't talk about the implications for comparative research, which was like the second part of the paper.
Yeah. Go for it.
So listening to your views, I'd love to hear what you think about the second part of the paper. Perot is really trying to bring together, like, you know, the whole body of scholarship at the time on organizations and try to draw some implications of his framework. And basically, you know, my 1-2 sentence summary is, you can't compare one organization to the other because obviously they're different. And so it's very, very difficult to say something about all of them. I'd love to hear what you think. When you think about, like, based upon Perot, you can identify some parameters that at the time they thought that shapes, like, why organizations are different. What do we look at now when we do comparative research, which is like a very important stream of research, and also thinking about, you know, the role of case studies? What we have seen is a tendency towards theoretical contributions, analytical generalizability rather than empirical. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Like, this was just something in my mind, like, I don't know where to put it. I see how this is like a very useful paper to give to PhD students to think about, like, you know, if you want to do a comparative study, think about what types of organization you want to compare and if that makes sense in the first place. But then thinking about theoretically, like, if we do our research and who do we speak to? Yeah, I kind of fell silent there in my thinking, and it didn't really feel like at ease with the conclusions he derived there. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
My first reaction, which is probably not going to be a complete one, it made sense, his arguments that, you know, regardless of how you study the organizations, that if you're going to, including within the same industry, which I would assume is what he means by within type. That if you're looking at organizations within an industry, you have to control for the type of work being done, because even the same industry, the same types of organizations in the industry perform their work differently based on the context. That was a very, very useful notion, because I do know that we've read other works where they really try not to do that, where they basically try to control based on the type of organization, to say that it is this particular type of an organization, and therefore we compare this company with this company or whatever, even though the two companies may go about things differently, or what they do is just a little bit different. Client differentiation, task differentiation, all of those sorts of things. So I do think it's a useful caution, because I can imagine, please help me with this, that there was a tendency to try to find, more Woodward studies where you study like a whole bunch of organizations to draw a small set of common generalizable conclusions, when in the reality of it, if we really wanted to compare organizations properly and fairly, you had to get in depth and you had to ensure that what you were comparing, that you were in fact comparing apples to apples, even of the same type of organization. Because sometimes it's very easy to come up with the fruit salad and not really offer conclusions that really do make sense for the organizations that you're studying.
Yes, so I agree with you, Tom. I think I had kind of one positive and one negative comment to say about this question. So the positive one is, I agree with you. I really like this precaution that he makes about, let's not think that because organizations might have a similar function or belong to a similar industry, they will have the same kind of technology or work and therefore the same kind of structure. So I really like that. And I think I agree with that. The thing that I found problematic in terms of, so like Greta said, in terms of giving this, to somebody that wants to study and compare organizations, is that because, and we've made this point before, because an organization might have different types of might be doing different types of work, the difficulty of identifying which type of work in the organization is more important for understanding the structure, if that makes sense, and knowing what kind of organizations you can compare. And I think the work of trying to identify, if it's routine or non-routine or craft or engineering technology, that it's more similar to what that organization does, it would require a very big effort and a lot of knowledge to understand not just what gets recognized as the formal work of the organization, but what might actually be the most valued work within the organization that therefore affects the structure to a greater extent.
So we can probably explore there more in the second part. What I wanted to say looking back is that the paradigm Perot was trying to put forward, unfortunately, did not win the paradigm war in organizational research, right? Because we have unfortunately become a bit obsessed with a higher level of abstraction and generalization. And therefore, the idea that how you organize, there is something that we should be attentive to, the claims we put forward, what are the boundary conditions in organizational terms that are expected, have not been the primary question, right, in the theorizing we do. And interestingly, Bob Hynings and others have written about that. And it's no surprise, because that was a core insight from the Aston School, right? So Perot is getting at that it's important that we preserve a sense of where we can expect that, and that organizational research should be a mid-range type of endeavor, not as psychology that is trying to get at, truths that are based on regularities that are at the biological level, or some forms of social science that are trying to get at regularities at the macro social level, right? So we can probably discuss more of that. But I think that this insight is not just relevant in terms of the future theorizing we may do, but as Greta was saying, it allowed us to appreciate, if we follow the footsteps, how different perspectives may apply to certain conditions, which is something extremely rare. And I was very surprised to see that he ends the paper in exactly trying to say, well, everyone is right in so far organizational theorizing. That just happens to be right for different organizations. And that's what he's trying to do. And it's very brief, but he tries to say that some of the Selznick that we discussed some episodes before on the whole aspect of tools gain this more meaningful type of life of their own, so to speak. And he says, well, you can expect that if you're talking about non-routine parts of the organization, in which strategy and all this kind of forward thinking, it's not just about getting concrete work done right here, right now, but there is space for thinking what kind of tools we should use and so on and so forth. And you know, and he does that with a few theories in trying to say that, and it's interesting because in a way that it was an early day and there was already a proliferation of competing ways to understand organizations, right? And it just became more and more complicated since then. But again, as I think it's an interesting insight that unfortunately has not been prevalent, but I think would be interesting to develop, is to try to think how some of our perspectives in understanding organizations can speak to certain situations, given the way the organization is organized.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.